This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Remember the debt limit fight, all the arguing and politicking that we went through? Yeah, never mind about that, at least for now. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 10th of May. Good to have you with us. And here is where we're going to start. Fannie Mae, the government-owned mortgage company, as you know. Last time you thought of them, probably about the financial crisis, right, and the bailout they got. But here is a fresh context to consider the debt limit and how Fannie's helping us all out there. They are going to pay a dividend to the Treasury Department, almost $60 billion, which will help ease the debt limit pain a little bit, which is good because it was set to go back into effect next week. We're going to get there and more with our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond. Felix Salmon from Reuters is in. Felix, where are you? Boston this week. Neela Richardson is from Bloomberg Government. She is in Washington, D.C. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So, Felix, this is good news, right, that we don't have to worry about the debt limit now because between the sequester and Fannie Mae and less spending, we can, you know, kick it down the road till October, right? Good news?
Well, I mean, if you're going to have a big fight over the debt limit, is it better to have a fight in October than it is to have a fight in May? I have no idea.
I'm not asking the questions here, Felix. I don't know. Is it?
I think it's kind of impressive that this clever little accounting gimmick that Fannie Mae discovered about tax credits has turned into $60 billion of real money, which is going to the government. Yay, good for us. But the debt limit fight is absolutely certain to happen sooner or later and at some point this year.
Neela, are they in Washington just going, phew, and mopping their brow and saying, we don't have to deal with this for another 6 months?
You know, not only do they not have to deal with the debt ceiling, they don't have to deal with Fannie Mae. You know,
the company's now
profitable, and the calls for reform are much less frequent when the company is actually making the government money and putting off decisions for the government. It's a win-win all around.
Okay, wait a minute. Hold on. How can it be a win-win when we're going to have this conversation anyway? And what we've done is given Washington, Neela, another way to say, oh, we don't have to deal with this now. We're going to have to, as Felix said, we're going to have this conversation.
Exactly. It's a hard conversation to have, either housing reform, what to do with Fannie Mae and its rival Freddie Mac, and what to do with the debt ceiling and government spending. We have been a conversation avoiders for the last several years, and there's nothing right now that's going to point to a conversation and more importantly, decision making.
Felix, are you confident at all that there will be a decision on the debt limit when we get there in October?
There will neither be a decision nor will there be any finality on what's going to happen to Fannie and Freddie, who, for all that they are actually making money right now, do need to shrink to a point of irrelevance while at the moment they're basically owning the entire mortgage market in the U.S. and no one is writing mortgages unless they can sell them to Fannie and Freddie. That's not healthy. We can't have the government underwriting every mortgage that everyone buys in America.
Right. And Kai, yeah, Felix is absolutely right about that. But meanwhile, where there's basically a standstill and no action, Wall Street is betting. And Wall Street's betting big that the companies will be returned basically to their former status. So Wall Street's taken a big risk here by buying up common stock and preferred stock of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And we'll see how long this lasts as well.
Speaking of Wall Street, Felix, Jamie Dimon, there's this move afoot. The meeting is in, what, like 10 days, the shareholder meeting, to strip him of that chairman title and make him only the CEO of JP Morgan Chase. A, do you care? And B, should the rest of us?
I care. I think this is huge. If it happens, and no one knows whether it will or not, it would be a real vote for genuine corporate governance in America and especially at America's biggest banks. But you know, it would also be tantamount to firing him, since there's no way that he's going to stay on as CEO with some other chairman.
You think he'll just pack it in and take his toys and go home?
You know, I think he's going to keep both titles, at least under Jamie Dimon's chairman and CEO role. We know where the buck stops. We know who to point the fingers at when things go wrong. And there's no academic research that actually splitting these two positions actually improves board oversight. What you need is a good skill set on the board that is at par with Jamie Dimon's skill set.
What does it say, Felix?
There is actually academic research saying
right,
that it's
well, you know what?
A
we'll,
good
we'll,
idea.
I'll tell you what,
we can debate that offline at any time.
But we have like a minute, Felix, and we'll try to cram this in there. I want to ask you what it means that we've gotten to the place in America where real financial corporate reform comes down to whether or not one guy keeps two jobs. Are you kidding me?
It's a bit pathetic, isn't it, really? But, you know, we've had genuine reform of the banks, you know, in visible ways through Dodd-Frank and in less visible ways through my favorite thing. You're going to love this guy, Basel III,
which
no one talks about, but it's really important. Visible stuff. And, yeah, you're right. It's not huge, but it would be great if it happened.
Felix Salmon from Reuters. He's in Boston today. Neela Richardson from Bloomberg Government. She was down in Washington, D.C. Thanks, you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, we'll see you soon. Wall Street, as long as we're talking about it, went back to its winning ways to end the week. Details, numbers, you know the drill. We closed the show yesterday with a quick item about what seems to be a global ATM heist for the ages, a gang of cyber thieves that did $45 million worth of withdrawals. The high-tech part of it involved hacking into financial accounts all over the world and moving money around. The low-tech part was making homemade debit cards that would get away with it in one important center of international banking. That would be this one. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
To simplify, this was a two-part crime. The bad guys stole debit card information online and then pasted that info onto magnetic stripe debit cards, the kind you and I use. Easy peasy, says fraud analyst Julie Conroy at the ITA Group. You can buy the equipment to do this for $25.
So you can take any ordinary plastic card, it can be an old gift card that you've gotten, create your own magnetic stripe, and then use it just like any other ATM card.
Magnetic stripe technology is older than the Ford Pinto. It let the crooks here make duplicate debit cards to use all at once.
It was really choreographed.
Financial researcher Brian Riley is with CEB Tower Group.
Within the course of 10 hours, thousands of transactions passed through. And if you saw the map that was released, it showed a map going straight down Broadway.
The U.S. is the world's only advanced economy using magnetic stripes. Fraud consultant Jerry Silva says other countries have newer technology.
That put a chip on the card, and now you had kind of a double layer of security.
They're harder to copy, and cards with chips generate a unique code for every transaction. So we want that.
But the cost of replacing all of the plastic in this country, the cost of upgrading every ATM to date has exceeded the cost of the fraud itself.
One reason Americans are in this situation is we invented credit cards, so we have the older infrastructure, says cybersecurity analyst Chris Weissappel at Veracode.
A lot of times the early adopters of technology are stuck with, you know, a generation one system, and I think that's what we have here.
Still, the higher tech cards are coming to the U.S. in the next few years, just in time for the hackers to get a little more creative. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
You've had this happen to you, right? You're streaming music or video on your smartphone, and you all of a sudden realize it's using up a whole lot of data and that your phone bill is going to be ginormous. Except for those lucky souls who are grandfathered in, unlimited data plans are pretty much a thing of the past, which, as it turns out, is a big concern for content providers, the companies that make whatever you're watching or listening to. So they're thinking about maybe subsidizing that data you're using. Marketplace's David Gura explains.
Today, there are more ways than ever to watch a show or to listen to music. David Fink, a technology expert at Russell Reynolds Associates, says the entertainment ecosystem is crowded and competitive, and smartphones are a big part of that.
Everyone is looking to increase revenue and profitability, and everybody's looking for a way to leverage other parts of the ecosystem in order to do that.
This week, the CEO of Verizon Wireless said the company is looking at a new model. Advertisers and content providers would subsidize consumers by paying for part of their data plan. That'd be good news for media companies. They'd get viewers.
The reason you want to deliver your content is so that you can get valuable advertising dollars.
It'd be good news for consumers. They'd save money. And it'd be good news for wireless companies. They'd continue making money off all that data. Rob Frieden teaches telecom law at Penn State. He says watching shows on smartphones gets us one step closer to something.
The end of appointment television as we know it.
He says no one wants to set a clock anymore to watch one show on one channel on one platform.
People are expecting anytime, anywhere, over any device access to content.
More Americans are spending more time watching video on smartphones, on average about 5.5 hours a month. If data plans were subsidized, chances are there'd be more demand. Weston Hendrick with Current Analysis says wireless companies have to be cautious. A surge in demand could clog their networks.
As much as carriers like the additional data revenue, they have to be very careful in terms of their network planning and how quickly they can add additional capacity.
They'll have to move fast. According to Cisco, by 2017, 2/3 of the world's mobile data traffic will be video. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
This is a big college graduation weekend. Festivities are tomorrow, in fact, at Georgia State University down in Atlanta. Students and their families will, of course, be celebrating. So, too, though, will the school, because more than half the students who came to Georgia State as freshmen are going to get their diplomas. That's a way higher graduation rate than Georgia State had a decade ago. From WABE in Atlanta, Jim Burris explains how they did it.
Here's the thing about graduation rates. The calculation starts the second a student steps foot in class. And it doesn't matter if that student drops out on day one or one day before graduation. When you're talking numbers, it's all the same. Lucille McGee was on the fast track to becoming a dropout statistic.
I am the definition of a non-traditional student from my age to being a mother.
2 years ago, Lucille moved from New Jersey to Atlanta to attend GSU. She was 24, the first in her family to go to college, and she had a new baby. But when she showed up on campus, the tuition money she thought would be there wasn't. Lucille was about $3,000 short with no way to pay. She told herself,
I am older, so maybe I just have to go back to work and save my money.
But really, she knew better.
I knew in the back of my mind I would not be returning.
Georgia State saw this pattern over and over. Bright, capable students walking away because they just didn't have the money.
A number of the students we were dropping were short by $300, by $400.
Tim Rennick is Vice Provost and Chief Enrollment Officer at Georgia State.
When I sometimes present this account to outside audiences, they say, well, why didn't they, you know, go to their parents to get the money? Why didn't they get a loan from a bank to get that money or for some other sort of loan? And the reality is a lot of these students are maxed out.
So a few years ago, the university instituted what's called a bridge grant. The administration flagged students who were automatically dropped for non-payment. Those who owed the least got their grants first, and it went on down the line until the pot ran out. GSU President Mark Becker provided the initial seed money out of his own pocket, about $40,000.
Higher education was transformational in my life. I was a first-generation college student, saw that the life that I was able to live because of having a college education.
The Bridge Fund is now worth a couple $1 million. But it's just one way the school keeps students on track to graduate from the minute they arrive on campus. Another is data. GSU found that students often get derailed because they take classes that don't count toward graduation. With 32,000 students, it's not like staffers can check every registration, but a computer can. Now the school flags students if they're headed for trouble. It's cheap and easy. Matthew Chingos is a fellow at the Brookings Institution. He studies college graduation rates. Chingo says colleges often pour tons of money into improving graduation percentages.
Colleges spend money on lots of different things, on research, on teaching, on student support.
He says more money isn't necessarily better.
And in general, there isn't that much of a correlation once you take into account student characteristics.
In other words, things like SAT scores and socioeconomic status play a bigger role in getting students across the finish line than the amount of cash a school throws at the problem. But studies show a little help can go a long way in creating success stories, like Lucille McGee's.
I plan to go to medical school upon graduation.
She's got two semesters to go. As far as tomorrow's graduation, Georgia State will hand out a record-setting 4,000 diplomas, including 300 to students who might not have made it a decade ago. In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
Coming up, live tweeting takes on a whole new meaning.
So how it would work is if you were on Twitter, into the bar that I add onto Twitter, you would just type in scandal, and it would block out all tweets that are talking about scandal.
It's going to change your lives, people. But first, let's do the numbers. A little bit goes a long way when you're in record territory, you know, gang. The Dow Industrials picked up just 0.2% today, 35 points. Another record close, though, 15,118, the number. The NASDAQ jumped 0.8%, 27 points, finished at 3,436. The S&P 500 tipped up 0.4%, 7 points, ended at 1,633. For the week that was, the Dow up 1%, the NASDAQ packed on 1.7%, the S&P 500 pulled 1.2% ahead. Financially speaking, Morgan Stanley ascended 2.25%. Citigroup tipped up 0.3%. Bank of America took home 0.8%. Now the earnings grab bag. How about that? Priceline picked up 3.75% after a strong quarterly report. Molycorp, with its huge deposit of rare earths, shined up 31% on higher revenues. And yesterday's good earnings for Tesla kept its stock humming. Shares in the electric car maker charged up 10% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.90% on the nose. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for April. President Obama is scheduled to meet with British Prime Minister David Cameron at the White House. And hey there! Yes, you, the guy at the sushi bar yelling into your phone during my dinner. It's National Etiquette Week, so get a clue. I mean, please, get a clue. Thanks. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. High tech has come to the America's Cup, and it's proving to be something of a double-edged sword, dangerous and essential all at the same time. British sailor Andrew Simpson died yesterday when the boat he was crewing on capsized in San Francisco Bay. And I say boat there only in the sense that a Formula One race car is still a car as we know it. Gigi Duban reports the modern sailing industry relies on that kind of technology to keep fans interested.
A high-performance yacht these days, light and fast, doesn't so much sail as it hovers. Ben Farnborough is associate publisher of Boat International Media.
None of it is in the water other than the rudder and a daggerboard, so it's essentially flying.
Flying faster than ever before. And Farnborough says because the yachts move at such high speeds, we're seeing new safety precautions.
The guys on the AC-72s are wearing crash helmets, which is something that we've not seen before in sailboat racing.
The AC-72 is the boat that flipped over in an America's Cup training accident yesterday. And while lots of people are questioning its safety, others say events like the America's Cup need yachts that are at the forefront technologically. And that comes with risk. Lee Tawney is executive director of the National Sailing Hall of Fame.
Safely, one could answer the same questions when you fly a new kind of airplane or, you know, test anything that's on the edge.
Tawney says the race does need to be safe. Unfortunately, the slower yachts just aren't as exciting to watch. Stuart Stroily is senior editor at Sailing World magazine. He says these high-speed yachts are meant to draw a crowd.
They want the competition to be exciting enough and easy enough to comprehend that non-sailors who saw it on TV would stop and watch and not turn away. And in the past, that's been a big problem.
And sailors in the America's Cup can use all the advertising dollars they can get. After all, these boats can cost more than $10 million each. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
I spend a lot of time on Twitter, as I think I've said. It helps me keep up with the news, but sometimes it does more harm than good. I'm talking about live tweeting here, specifically sporting events that I've TiVo'd or a certain primetime drama or two. You forget you're going to watch them later. You check your Twitter feed and boom, spoiler, major plot points or a key scene ruined. High school senior Jenny Lemire has the answer, born of her own live tweeting experiences. She's made an app. It's called TiVo that lets her and the rest of us safely peruse our Twitter feeds. Spoilers be damned. Jenny, it's good to talk to you.
Yeah, it's nice to talk to you, too.
Listen, I have to ask you where you were last night, man, because Scandal last night totally got ruined for me because I was on Twitter.
Oh, man, yeah.
So tell me how your thing would have worked for me last night, and I wouldn't have had Scandal ruined for me.
So how it would work is if you were on Twitter into the bar that I add onto Twitter, you would just type in Scandal, and it would block out all tweets that are talking about Scandal. The text would just be replaced by a green bar, so you know that they're there, but you just can't read them. And then when you sat down to watch the show, you would just hit play, and the tweets would stream down, so you would still get the experience of live tweeting, even though you're not watching it live.
Now, do you, I mean, have you used it in real time for yourself yet?
Yeah, I have.
And?
And it's awesome.
What is it about this that appeals to you?
I just think the cool thing is if I'm just like, oh man, I really wish someone made an app that, say, blocks spoilers on Twitter, then I can just be like, oh, I can do that.
See, now that's
funny.
I'll
just make it for myself.
I say that all the time. I just don't have the oomph to do that. I wouldn't have the first idea of how to do that. This thing could conceivably be worth a lot of money. I would pay 99 cents. I would probably pay $1.99 for this app. Is it going to make you rich? Are you going into business?
I'm working to release it, but it's going to be available for free.
Oh, how come?
I just want to get the app out there. I just want people to get to use the product. And I think one of the main markets is for teens, and like I wouldn't want to pay for it. So,
How long until everybody gets their hands on it?
It should just be a few weeks. I just need to do some tweaks to get it ready from working on my Twitter to working on everyone's Twitter.
Oh, yeah, that's kind of a problem. Now, would it work on, like, TweetDeck and all those other client things, not just the proper Twitter app, or what?
Right now, it only would work in Google Chrome and Firefox, but maybe in later versions I can get it to work in apps as well.
Have you been approached? Are people trying to buy this thing off of you? Do they want to hire you? Are you sort of a hot commodity now?
I've gotten about 7 internship offers, and I've gotten some offers to partner up with companies.
Are you going to take any, or are you just going to sit on them for a while?
Yeah, I think I'm going to take an internship. I'm just not sure which one yet.
Yeah.
And I'm working with a company, Furious Minds, to release the app in a few weeks.
Excellent. And you're going to stick with the name TiVo?
Yes, it stands for TiVo for Twitter.
Now, did you come up with that?
Oh, no, my dad. I came up with the idea, and he's like, oh, so it's like TiVo for Twitter. And so we're like, oh, TiVo.
Jenny Lemire, she is an entrepreneur, she is a developer, or a hacker, I guess you might say, and a high school senior up in New Hampshire. Jenny, thanks a bunch.
Yeah, thank you.
When you TiVo something and watch it later, like I was talking about with Jenny Lemire and that Twitter app, the beautiful part is that you can skip the ads. But commentator Beth Tytel says these days, not only are the ads all around us, companies are trying to get us to do their work for them.
Believe me, I know the point of Mad Men is not to make us nostalgic for the good old days of advertising. But at least back then, as smarmy as the ad men were, the game was more straightforward. Companies wanted your money, and they ran ads to get it. Okay, so that hasn't changed exactly. Companies still want your money. But now, they actually try and make you work to make it easier to sell you their products. Oh, I'm sorry. You thought that when your favorite DJ asks you to vote on whether you prefer your candles vanilla or cinnamon-scented, or which way you like your toilet paper to hang, or who was the best dressed at the Great Gatsby premiere, it's because she's interested in your thoughts? Ha! It's all part of a two-part ploy. Step 1, lure you to the company website, Facebook page, or Twitter feed. Step 2, motivate you to like or share or pin or rank or rate or comment or complete a survey. Anything to build a relationship or to show advertisers that you're engaged. Can't we just watch or listen in peace? Apparently not. The quest for engaged consumers is relentless. ABC wants me to follow my favorite Shark Tank shark on Twitter. CNN.com wants me to submit my suggestion for the country's best beer town. The local oldie station nags me to stop by on Facebook and tell the hosts about incidents in which I've almost injured myself in the bathroom. Even I don't care about that. Or do I? Listeners, tweet me and let me know your opinion.
Beth Tytel is a reporter for the Boston Globe. You can take her up on that offer should you so choose. She's on Twitter at Beth Tytel. We are at Marketplace APM. You can get me at Kai Rizdahl, or you can just unplug for the weekend and have some time for yourself. That's it. We ran a little contest here this week. You might remember naming rights, if you will, for our two conference rooms. You guys voted. Here's the winner.
My name is Emerson Beyer, and I chose Dubin and Arlen in honor of the writers of the songs We're in the Money and Stormy Weather. And I look forward to every day hearing which of those two great songs is going to be on the show.
There you go. Get a glimpse of the new signage for our conference rooms. It is at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, yet another lesson on the perils of the digital age. Bloomberg, the company that makes those data terminals that are ubiquitous on Wall Street, has been accused of surreptitiously snooping on its clients. Apparently, there's a function in the Bloomberg software someplace that lets Bloomberg staffers see what their customers are using the terminals for, including, says the business website Quartz, what Alan Greenspan was looking for when he hit the help key back when he was the Fed chairman. I love that bit. The whole thing came to light because a reporter for Bloomberg News said to a guy at Goldman Sachs, "Hey, have you left the firm? Because I haven't seen you logging in for a while." Bloomberg says its journalists now are no longer allowed to use that snoop function anymore. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up just 0.2%, 35 points. The NASDAQ up 0.8%, 27 points. The S&P 500 tipped up 0.4%, 7 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. JJ Yore is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you Monday. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.